2012, January 3rd. Today is Lecture 1, Introduction to the Course for Astronomy 141 for Winter Quarter 2012. This course is called Life in the Universe. Now, about 10 or 20 years ago, that would have been a very short course because we didn't know squat. It would have been very difficult to have put that course onto any kind of firm basis. But in fact, this course, and in fact the whole question of life in the universe, gets at one of mankind's oldest questions: are we alone? Now, are we alone might have been a more local question. We might have been sitting in one valley and wondering if there was anyone living in the other valley. Someone who might be our friend. Someone who might become a family member. Maybe someone who might not be our friend. But we were always curious, what was over the next hill? Who's around the other bend? And as we began, we're a very curious species. We've always been a very curious species. And so this question of, is there life not only on the planet that we know and have grown up on and evolved on, an important one to us, but also the question as we look up into the sky and began to realize those points of light were in fact other stars, other suns, and those other suns could have other planets, we began to ask the question, could life have arisen around those stars as well? This is a very, very old question in astronomy. In fact, in the oldest records of astronomical thinking, going back to the 5th century BC, we even see people beginning speculations about the possibility of life on other worlds. But these speculations can be broken down into scientific questions, questions which can be answered, falsified, in which we can apply all of the machinery of logic and scientific practice to their answering. So it's not mere speculation over a couple of beers. We can actually ask the question, is there life on other planets, by bringing it down into answerable, testable questions. We might ask the question, is there life on other planets in our own solar system? Are there other places besides the Earth around our sun where the conditions of life have arisen and where life in fact itself has arisen? Are there planetary systems around other stars? Are we the only solar system, or are there other solar systems around? If there are solar systems, are there any of those that are like our system, or are they different in some way? And do those differences perhaps make the difference between them being sterile and filled with life? If there are planetary systems, do any of them harbor planets that are like the Earth? What do we mean by like the Earth? What do we mean by conditions for life? That's part of the questions that this course is going to attempt to answer. And then, of course, if we were to find an Earth-like planet around another star, we would immediately begin asking the question, has life arisen on any of those worlds? And this gets us into even more advanced questions. If life has arisen, is any of that life intelligent life? Can we talk to it? Are we friendly with it? Or does it threaten us? We don't know. So in science, we prefer to ask questions that we can answer quantitatively rather than just simply idly speculating. So the question is, how do we take this idea, are we alone in the universe, is there life elsewhere in the universe, and begin to address it scientifically? So this becomes the question now, what is it we need to know to begin to address that question? What are the data? What are the concepts? What are even the basis for asking those questions? Another question is how we even begin to structure the scientific inquiry. It isn't enough to ask the question. We must ask the question in a way that moves our knowledge forward. So maybe if we ask too broad and too general a question, are we alone, we need to break it down into sub-questions which will lead us in the direction of that answer, even if it doesn't lead us directly to that answer in one big jump. This may be a generational question rather than something one can answer sitting around thinking about it for an afternoon. The other thing is, what are the various pieces of the puzzle that we're going to need to understand in order to make progress? Where are the places where our ignorance exists and how we can push forward? So a lot of this class is going to be looking at laying down the intellectual basis for answering this question as we've risen to it over the past few decades. It's a very interesting endeavor because it brings together not just astronomy, but a wide variety of areas. It brings together geology and others. Now, what is science? We need to know how science works. Science is hard to describe. People talk about it in terms of scientific method. The definition I've come to over many years is that science is not so much about what we know, but how we as human beings have learned to confront what we do not know. Science has less to do with our knowledge as to how we build, construct, and critically examine that knowledge. Okay, so one does not become a scientist by memorizing facts, by having an encyclopedic memory of all the wonderful things that we know about in the world. Science is the process by which we're able to sift between those ideas that work and those that do not, to recognize good data and bad data, to push ideas forward, and to know when an idea is going nowhere and to discard it and move on. What science does is it provides us with an intellectual framework in which to ask these questions and in which to evaluate the answers. It's one thing to ask questions. When I was a kid growing up, there was a button that was really popular that said question authority. And I always wondered, well, what are you going to do with the answer you get if authority actually answers? And that's the difference between just asking a question. You can't stop with the question. You've got to know, what am I going to do with the answer when I get it? How do I evaluate whether I've even gotten the answer right? How do I evaluate that answer doesn't lead to other questions? The way science does this, it relies on use of verifiable data, which means data that I can take, that other people can take, and verify is true. I can't just make stuff up. I've got to basically be able to verify that what I've shown you is real. It's a phenomenon that I can measure, that others can measure as well if they follow my techniques, or even develop new techniques and come at it from a different direction. Furthermore, these measurements must be quantitative. I can say, yeah, it kind of looks bright, is no substitute for actually measuring how bright something is or what it's made of. Guesswork doesn't count. You really want measurements that you can confirm and verify. The other thing that science brings to it, and this is part of what science is, not just that body of knowledge. Science is really a body of best practices we have developed over many centuries now, but really over the last three centuries and change. And these best practices really come down to how we critically examine the validity of the interpretations that we draw from data. I can gather the best data in the world with the most advanced and expensive equipment you can imagine. But if I don't have a way to critically examine that data and be able to figure out what the hell it means, I go nowhere. All that data becomes utterly useless. And so what science is the series of practices we've developed for critically examining that data and moving forward. So in this course, when we go forward in this topic, we're going to be asking these questions that are hopefully going to lead us in the direction of the answer to the question, are we alone? And we're going to do that by looking at what data do we have? What knowledge do we have that can bring us forward? And what ways can I critically examine that to know, is this data adequate? Do I need more? Or am I on a completely wrong path? And that's the practice of science. We're all scientists at some fundamental level. We all practice science, even without a degree. Right? You run into a question you can't answer and you begin a series of problem solving. How do you winnow? That solves a problem from something else. Right? You come home, you go to sit down and read a book, you click on the lamp doesn't light. You've just got a problem. How do you solve it? Well, you might say, gee, why is the lamp out? Maybe the lamp's burned out. So you go and you steal your roommate's light and you put it in place, turn the switch, no light. Okay, so either you had two bad lamps or you just got unlucky, or that's not the problem. So you now have eliminated that solution. The lamp was bad. So you try switching it on and off a few times. That's called repeating the previous action in the hope of a different outcome. Einstein referred to that as madness, but in fact that may just be that you've got an intermittent failure and maybe you're showing you're cleaning off the contacts. Nope, that didn't work. So you try various experiments, trying ways to make that light come back on. And also remember that part of this exercise might be bringing in the opinions of others. You never know where the critical insight might come from. When your roommate walks in and says, dude, why isn't it plugged in? There's your critical insight, plug it in, there's the answer, it wasn't plugged in. Of course, you've got to deal with him when he finds out you stole his lamp, but you know, that's a different problem. We're all scientists. It's a question of applying the practice and recognizing that practice in everyday life. Okay. So what are some of the questions we're going to run into? One of the questions that really fascinates people, and I probably drew many of you to this, of course, is when we think of life in the universe, we're immediately drawn to the question of intelligent life. Are there, in fact, intelligent lives that have developed civilizations that want to communicate with us, that we might actually come in contact with? So we have to ask the question, to get to that wonderful answer, which we would love to know, we have to ask some questions that lead up to it. One of them is, what are the requirements for life? Where should we be looking? Where are the places in the universe where life is likely to arise as we understand it? Are our views of where life can exist maybe too provincial? Maybe the Earth is not a good prototype. We don't know that, so maybe we should push the extremes of life on Earth. If we do, in fact, get past the questions of where life can exist, we might start asking, what are the requirements for communication? What do we mean by communicate? What is required for intelligence? In fact, how do we define intelligence? How will we recognize intelligence when we see it? Other questions which we can take, again, we have to draw analogies from ourselves, is how long does it take for life to develop? How long did it take on Earth for life to reach the point that it, you know, we're around? And then for that standpoint, how long did it take to reach intelligent life? How long do intelligent civilizations last? This last one is a difficult question and got a lot of guesswork about it. But we can actually come to some understandings. It might be based on science. It might be based on astronomy and geology. The changes in those environments, can we survive them or do we go extinct? What is the cause of species to go extinct on the Earth? So there's a wide range of ways to approach these questions from a disparate series of answers. So what this course is going to do is we're going to do this by charting an understanding of the scientific progress we've taken towards answering this question. We're going to be asking, what is the cultural and historical background of this question? Why does it even mean anything for us to ask this question? Does it bias our inquiry because of that cultural background? Are we looking at the problem with blinders and we have to remove those blinders to make progress? We want to ask the questions, what is the nature of life on Earth? We've got at least one good example in front of us of a place that life in a tremendous diversity has arisen. What lessons can we draw from that, from life on Earth, that will then give us a way to apply that elsewhere out in the universe? And we can start by asking a question which we might even are just beginning to be able to technologically answer. Is there life elsewhere in the solar system? Where should we be looking in our solar system? We just now have the capability to reach any body in our solar system via a robotic spacecraft. So we are now at the point where we could, if we identified a place as possibly where there could be life, we can, with a bit of national will and existing technology, go there. Okay, maybe go there with a robotic surrogate, but we can go there and make tests and measurements. So how do we pick where to go? And what are we looking for when we go there? And that's a question we're going to address in this course. Is there life elsewhere in the universe? If we take our solar system as an analog and we say, what conditions are necessary for life, where might I find those conditions elsewhere? And so we'll look at the advances we've had in finding planetary systems around other stars, of applying the things we've learned in our planet and in our solar system to those other places. And we're going to find that the answers are often very surprising. And finally, we can ask what the future of life is on Earth and in the universe. Are there limits to life not only forming, but where life may end? And maybe that will inform our search. It's a large, lonely place out there, but we don't know how lonely yet. So here's how we're going to break it down. We're going to start by asking about the historical and cultural background of the question of life in the universe. And this is going to bring together three areas. We're going to talk about the Copernican Revolution. What is the place of the Earth and us within our solar system? The chemical revolution. What are we made of? What is the structure of matter? The biological revolution. What does it mean to be alive? What is life? How did we learn what life was and even begin to inform that as a scientific question? The geological revolution. How do we look at the place we live on, the Earth? How do we view it as a physical system and how do we apply that knowledge to elsewhere? And finally, the cosmological revolution. How do we understand how just understanding the Earth with its life on it and our solar system, how does that fit into the much larger structure we call the universe? Everything. Life, the universe, and everything literally in this. How did we come to understand the age of the universe, the scale of the universe, and its what its contents are? These five revolutions, as I'll call them, set the stage for the question of the inquiry of, is there life on other worlds? Without each of these revolutions having been completed and formed a formal scientific base of inquiry that now exists in the 20th and 21st centuries, the question of life in the universe would simply be idle speculation. We live at a very unique time in human history in which we have a deep understanding in a wide variety of areas, astronomy, physics, biology, chemistry, geology, that are now coming together, and we can actually start sensibly asking questions and getting answers we think we can understand and interpret. It's a very exciting time to be here. And this is a time in which we can actually begin to think we can make progress on these questions. So how do we get at that? The second piece is that gives us the basis upon which we're going to build this. We're going to then start an exploration of what is the origin and nature of life on the Earth. We're going to look at the history of the Earth, the geology, climate, and issues of habitability. Was the Earth always a place conducive to life? Was life inevitable or was it not? And how long do we expect life to remain on Earth? What is the nature of life on Earth? What is its chemistry? How does life on Earth work? That gives us a template for looking elsewhere. How did life perhaps originate on the Earth? That's another question which, again, gets to the question of how we should go about looking at and maybe look at the future of life on Earth. What is the prospects for future of the Earth's habitability? Is that going to always be habitable, or are there changes afoot? We have to ask that, because that too will inform where we're going to be looking. We then are going to go from the Earth out into our solar system, the eight planets, the various moons, subplanets, and dwarf planets, and so forth. We're going to take from the Earth the lessons of what do we think the requirements are life for? How extreme can things be and you still expect life to arise? And then ask, where else in the solar system are these requirements that we think apply to life are satisfied? Now, we haven't got a final answer to this. So as we learn more about life on Earth, we revise where we look in the solar system. So, for example, for a long time, looking out in the solar system, the only place people thought of looking for life was on the planet Mars. Mars is dry, frozen, barren. But maybe in the past it was warmer and wetter. And we think water is one of the requirements. Liquid water is a requirement for the arising of life. But what we've learned over the last few years is that life on Earth can survive in some phenomenally extreme circumstances. Extremes of heat and cold, extremes of acidity, extremes of salinity. Places where we could not survive, but microbes can. And so it's actually asked us to look for places elsewhere in the solar system where some of these conditions might exist. And we have three other surprising places. Europa, Titan, and Enceladus. They're giant moons of Jupiter and Saturn, respectively. These are places we're going to look at. Seriously, NASA is now thinking of spending literally billions of dollars with its partners with the European Space Agency to explore some of these worlds, to actually look more carefully to see if, in fact, our new thinking about what the requirements of life on Earth, maybe life has actually arisen elsewhere in our solar system. Maybe not intelligent life, but maybe microbiological life. We tend to focus so much on intelligent life. We as a species have only been recognizable on the Earth as an intelligent species for 100,000 years. The Earth is 4.5 billion years old. And there's been life on the Earth for the last 3.5, almost 3.8 billion years. Most of the life on Earth for most of its history was microbiological. So we shouldn't be so provincial as to just be looking for us. It might be teeming out there as single-cell life in some form. Why is the Earth habitable, but Venus and Mars are not? That question is going to be very important as we start looking to other planetary systems. And finally, we bring down to the question we really want to answer. Is there life elsewhere in the universe? To answer this, we have to first ask, is there places for life to arise? We're going to take a prejudice. And the prejudice is that life needs somewhere to stand or swim or fly, which means it needs a solid surface. It needs a solid planet. Planets are nice because they provide nice environments that can build atmospheres, that can give you liquid water. We think those are some of the primary requirements. We'll develop that in more detail, of course, as the course goes on. So the first thing we've got to go do is find out how often planets occur around other stars. When I first started teaching at Ohio State, the answer to, do we know of any planets around other stars? The answer was no. There weren't any. We only knew of our one solar system, ours. In January 2012, it's nearly 600 stars with planets around them. We have had an explosion of knowledge in the last two decades, which has completely revolutionized our view of how often planets emerge. You may have heard news stories from the last couple months from the Kepler mission about the first finding of Earth-sized planets maybe near their habitable zones in the stars. We are not there yet. We haven't found an Earth. We haven't found an Earth in its habitable zone around its star. But if you'd asked me 10 years ago if I thought I would see that in my lifetime, I'd go, yeah, probably not. If you ask me that question today, we might see the first plausible candidate maybe even before this course quarter is even over. We've come that far, that rapidly in our knowledge. This is one of the reasons why this inquiry is now being taken so seriously. Because if we ever do find an Earth-like planet in a habitable zone of its star, the desire to study it with every asset we have will become a deep cultural imperative. Because that deep curiosity, is there someone else there, is going to overwhelm absolutely everything. Trust me, right now it's merely academic, but when we have candidates, you're going to see a change in the world. It's going to really change the way people think. So this is not a minor problem. So that's the question is, what do we study if we find those planets? How will we tell? We probably can't go there. Maybe we could, but it's technologically difficult. We'll look at some of the problems of how you can physically go to another star. It's maybe not soluble by current technologies or Very, very slow. So how are we going to do this game if we only have the Earth to sit upon? We'll talk a bit about that. Then comes the question, what if we actually came across an intelligent species? We haven't yet. Some people think they have, but, you know, we haven't. But what would we do? How would we contact them? How would we communicate? Is there any way, how would we even go about doing that? What gets into that? It's an interesting question. It's not just science fiction. It actually gets into some interesting questions, both of culture as well as of science, of how you pull that off. And finally, we want to look at the long-term future of Earth and elsewhere in the universe. We're going to look at some pretty, well, kind of crazy questions that you might not expect in a formal college science course. We will actually discuss interstellar travel seriously. No Star Trek, no warp drives. But how would you actually do it? What are the physical problems involved in trying to physically move a human being or groups of human beings from one star to another? And if you could do it, what are the consequences? Maybe it has some observable consequences, some interesting both cultural and physical consequences we might not have thought of. So these are going to be questions we're going to address. What will we expect alien life should look like? Are there lessons we can learn from the evolution of life on Earth that might help inform those expectations? You know, every science fiction film you've seen until the rise of the massive use of computer graphics required human actors. So not surprisingly, a lot of aliens look an awful lot like a guy in a rubber suit. That doesn't say anything about convergent evolution, but it says a great deal about the power of the Screen Actors Guild. But we're starting to now ask the question, what is there about the bilaterally symmetric body form? What do we expect? These are actually questions we think we can begin to answer. They're very speculative, but once we get through most of the body of the course, by the last week, we're going to start diving into those questions. We're going to take these staples of science fiction, of movies and TV and books, and we're actually now going to turn the light of all of our explorations of life in the universe on those questions and maybe find some real surprises. So it's going to be an interesting class. This is a course which could not have been taught 10 years ago or so, or at least couldn't have been taught very seriously. We might have sprinkled a lecture or two in the big general classes. But we now live at a very unique time, I think, in human history where we're beginning to find answers. We really are beginning to find other worlds. In fact, there are more worlds around other stars than we knew of 10, 12 years ago. It is a completely different place than it used to be. And we are now in a place where our knowledge of biology and our knowledge of the biochemistry of life, our knowledge of chemistry, our knowledge of the geology of the Earth, our knowledge of the evolution and physics of stars, what are the lives of stars, and the dynamics of galaxies, have all begun to converge and give us real answers. Where do the chemical elements come from? Where do we expect them to be? The places where those chemical elements for life exist. Where should the planets be? What are the conditions for life? What is the nature of life on Earth? We have an amazing array of data, and as we're beginning to bring it together, we can now begin to seriously ask the question, are we alone? And maybe actually get an answer that means something. And that's what this course is going to be about, is a progress report on where we think that is going to be, and use this as a vehicle for giving you an update and knowledge in this course of the current state of affairs, primarily in astronomy, but in a lot of other fields that bear upon this question. Any questions before we go on? Well, with that, thank you very much. I'll see you all tomorrow at 12:30. Kick the light. See that slider right there? Just slide this one right to the top. There we go. Yeah.